Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. Welcome to Tia Time with Artist, and this week our guest is author, singer, songwriter, world traveler, and amazing all-around musician and person, Jamie Anderson. Thank you so much for coming to the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
We tend to, on the show, I just talk about what the artist trek is, what got you into what you do. Why do you do it? Why do you keep doing it? Because I get asked myself that all the time.
How much time do we have?
Exactly. Because this is the kind of thing when I go and I watch interviews on TV or late night, or no one ever talks about this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm famous. Okay, you're famous. You got this multi-million dollar movie, whatever.
Yeah.
But you weren't there 20 years ago. I never heard of you. What were you doing? How did you get there? What kinds of things did you have to do? And what kinds of things do you continue to have to do to just keep doing what we do?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what started you on your singer-songwriter journey?
I basically leapt out of the womb singing because my dad was a musician. So I heard lots of live music. I didn't always like it because you know how kids are. It's like, ew, dad, what a weird song. And then also I was a Girl Scout from second grade on. And Girl Scouts sing all the time when they're putting up a tent, when they're doing the dishes, when they're hiking. And a lot of them are pretty simple folk songs. And so when I picked up the guitar at age 15, it wasn't too hard to learn those songs that I'd been doing in Girl Scouts. And it also gave me exposure to other female musicians, which is an area that back in the 70s, so I'm old, this wasn't popular. There are very few well-known artists in the world in the 70s and even 80s, even today, not enough, who played their own instruments, wrote their own songs, and controlled their own music. But there I was in Girl Scouts with a million guitar players and lots of great songs to sing. And that really inspired me. That really told me, hey, you're a musician, go for it. And I was in a little band in high school for a couple of years. And then after high school, I came out as a lesbian. And so the lesbian bars often hired entertainment. So sometimes I did gigs like that. My first real gig was a benefit for the Phoenix Women's Center in 1979. And I didn't even know how to use a microphone. The sound guy had to show me how to use the mic. And I remember the producer saying to me, because there were several of us on the bill, she said, okay, you've only got 5 songs. And I'm thinking, I've only written 5, so I guess we're good. And because they only wanted original music at this event. And what really hooked me on an audience's reaction is that I had a song called Albino Roach Blues. And it's about this albino roach that sort of took over my kitchen. Who's ever seen an albino roach? I don't know. There it was. And the punchline at the very end was, it's just like having a man around the house. And I had to stop because the audience was laughing so freaking hard and so long. And I just sat there in front of this microphone I had just learned how to use thinking, okay, what do I do now? That just hooked me. It's really great to get that kind of feedback.
Was on page 20 of the Tucson Weekly. You're a Rhodes Scholar. I have a BS from a state university. I hope you like femmes. I own 40 skirts. I'm a big liberal and you'll like my cooking. You're really smart and handsome. I'm not bad looking. We're perfect for each other. Can't you see? help but swoon when you read the news. I've got 10 followers on Instagram and 21 subscribers on YouTube. No, 22. Your books are New York Times bestsellers. My mom says my books are the best ever seen. You've won Emmys and lots of awards. I won for Best Folk in Tucson in 93. Rachel Maddow, marry me. You've got a partner I can share. I have a wife, she won't care, I think. Rachel Maddow, marry me. Don't you want to live in Canada? Our anthem's easier to sing. We have free healthcare and milk in bags. We have 20% of the world's fresh water. I know you like to fish. I like to eat fish. Do you like older women? I just wrote you this song, and is this thing on? Rachel Maddow, marry me. I do.
I've done a lot of things in my life, a lot of different jobs. I've worked a lot of crummy blue collar jobs, but nobody applauds when you've done a great job. No one says, yeah, you cleaned the counter, rock on. But when you finish a song that makes them laugh or makes or moves them in some way, they applaud. They stop you after the performance and they say, wow, I really enjoyed that song you did. Or I've had that experience that you sung about too. And it's really a great way to connect with people.
Okay.
Anyway, after I did that big show that was a benefit for the Women's Center, I just started picking up any shows that I could. A lot of them were benefits. I was a feminist lesbian, so sometimes they were benefits for gay and lesbian organizations. That's what we said back then. We said gay and lesbian. We didn't have that alphabet soup we use today, which I'm not saying is wrong. We do want to include everyone, but back then, actually, we said gay. That was it, until the lesbians came forward and said, hello. And so I moved to Tucson. This is all in Phoenix, Arizona. And I moved to Tucson and performed there. And I went to the Michigan Women's Music Festival in the late 70s. And I sang at the open mic there. And after I finished, a woman came up to me and she said, I really enjoyed your music. And I said, great. And we connected. We exchanged addresses. And then not long after that, I heard from her. And she said, why don't you make an album? And this is before DIY. You couldn't record on your computer. You had to rent a studio. And I had a part-time crummy, I don't know, some part-time office job. And I was going to school full-time. You're kidding. Make an album. And turns out she was a doctor and she had the money. And she said, tell me how much it'll cost and I'll send you the money.
Wow.
If that isn't a sign from whomever, not just from her, but from the universe going, maybe you should consider this. Uh-huh. And it was just a little cassette recording, just a little tape. But she paid for it. And my friends played on it for free. And after that, I started recording more albums. I figured out how to pay for them. I got involved with a woman, Dakota, who co-produced my early albums and helped me get financing for them. And she was a great support. And throughout my career, there's usually somebody in the background who's providing emotional and financial support to what I do, because I come from a working class family. We don't have money. And it was not. And Dakota is the one who said, why don't you do music full time? And I was just finishing up school. And I'm like, I just spent 4 years in school. I'm going to go do this instead. I'd earned a degree in what they called personnel management back then, which was human resources now. And I said, no. And so I tried that. I worked as a paralegal in the attorney general's office in Tucson, but I got tired of people yelling at me all the time. Because that's what happens. They've just gotten fired from their job because they're black or disabled or whatever it is. And then I have to get in there and be their advocate. And it was really satisfying helping people, but it was really hard work. And so when she said, why don't you do music for a living? Then my mind went to, oh, you want me to play parties and weddings for the rest of my life? I don't think so. And she goes, no, do women's music or folk music. And I said, are you going to support me? And she goes, yeah. And I went, sure you are. And then I said, no, because I'm a proud woman. You know, I don't want charity. It felt like charity. It felt like some richer person coming to me and going, here, take this wad of money and make some music. I'm like, no. So I thought about it for a few months, slapped myself upside the head and said, what the hell? You should do music full time. And that's what got me touring, is that Dakota was there supporting me.
Warm summer evening, dinner with a friend, a voice from long ago startles me. Hey, how you been? Your face so familiar, where has the time gone? Your 12-year-old asks me, how do you know my mom? A lot of answers go through my mind. Some are funny, some unkind. I went for polite and safe, as you stood there with your kids and what's his name. After all this time, have you erased me from your life? Even your son doesn't know. There on that sidewalk, in that outdoor cafe, we exchanged pleasantries, hardly knowing what to say. I joked with your boy that I'm a celebrity. What's his name? Crossed his arms and glared at me. After all this time, have you erased me from your life? Even your son doesn't know. Someday you'll tell your kids you used to have a wife.
That's hugely important.
Hugely, because I have met a lot of talented people in my journey who did not have that kind of support. And, or who weren't very business-minded. That's another thing that I had, and the advantage of, is that I'm very organized and I know how to book tours, and I learned how to book tours.
Sure.
It wasn't like you could go to a class. I figured it out. And I recently lost a friend of mine, Slick Callahan, who is a very funny comic based in Phoenix. And like the funniest woman I have ever seen. I have seen people on TV not half as funny as her. But she never had good management. She didn't have business sense.
Right.
And so she passed away without people outside of Phoenix really knowing who she was. And that's really sad.
It happens a lot. It happens a lot. It's that dilemma of having to be everybody by yourself. Like, you're not,
yes,
a corporation. Even if you are a corporation on paper, you're you and maybe your wife or two other friends or just you most of the time. So you're trying to cover booking the tour, dealing with all those people in between, figuring out how you're going to pay for everything.
Yes.
And then advertising it and trying to get the community to come to the event.
Right.
And
And back in the day, printing the posters, getting them posted.
Oh, I did all that.
The snail mail and telephone calls and all of that. And it's changed mm-hmm. a little bit, but it's still all of that work. And it's just you. And you're supposed to write the songs, perfect the songs, sing the songs.
Exactly.
And it's like you can't be business mind and creative mind at the same time. It doesn't work that way. At least I don't know anybody that works that way for
you.
If
I may brag, I am pretty good at doing business. And I think I'm good at the creative end too. It's just that it's a lot of work for one person. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I've had a lot of support over the years, but the last probably 20 years, it's been me. Mm-hmm. People have generously contributed to my crowdfunding campaigns. And so it's not like no one has helped me. It's just that I'm the one who organizes everyone. I joke that I'm the CEO of me. But you're right. Lots of performers, we shouldn't ask our artists to do that. We should just ask our artists to be creative and do what they do best instead of saying, okay, have you spent 40 hours a week trying to book your gigs? Because if you haven't, you're not going to have enough gigs.
Right. And yeah, it's... That's what I'm saying. You can't be writing a song and perfecting that song to get it on that album that you have to produce while you're producing it. So the music has to be done. That's what I mean about you can't do it at the same time.
Oh, I get it.
It's like you have to be the artist completely when you're doing that part of it.
Yeah.
Creating all that music, organizing, okay, I'm gonna write these songs. This, you know, I've got 10 songs to go through. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. These are on the album. This is maybe for later. This is a one that doesn't fit with anything, but I love it. I'm going to make sure it's done. But you need a time period to actually just do that. Yep. Then once that's all done, and then you've got, then you say, okay, let's record all of them. Okay, let's record them so they're done. Okay, now they're done. Now let's put them into a product. Now I have to market it, do everything else to it, promote it. So then you can't get back to actually doing the music for maybe, I don't know, a couple of years. It's a lot. It is a lot. It is a lot.
Yeah. People have no idea. In fact, I sometimes forget. Last week, there is an organization called, oh my gosh, is it Musicians Exchange? I just forgot. But it's an organization that collects royalties for musicians all over the world.
Okay.
And I went up there to see if they owed me any money, and they haven't paid me for 4 years. I'm thinking, why haven't they paid me? And then I realized I had forgotten to upload my last two albums.
Oh my gosh.
Oops. Because I was busy doing all the other stuff that we were talking about. So I spent 2 hours uploading songs and titles. And then I had to look up all these numbers and copyright and all that junk. And in the end, I might get a $20 check. I don't know what I'm going to get. But
if you're lucky.
Yeah. And frankly, I'm sure you're the same way too. I don't do this for the money, but the money sure would be nice.
Yes. Yeah. In my career, I've ended up having to have a regular job just so that I could do my thing, because jazz violin is not like popping. It should be.
Yeah.
I joke with a couple of my friends who also play jazz strings, and basically in the jazz world, they allow for one violin player at a time. Like there's only one, and that's it. Even though there's several hundred of us at least, but or probably thousands, but there's just one that they pinpoint on, and that one stays there for 30 years, 40 years, and then they pick another one.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's insane.
And you're also talking about a genre that has loyal followers, but not a lot of them. It's not like pop music.
Yeah.
So when you play in a jazz club, 50 people is a great crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you're a famous person, if ever it is in place, that makes it extra hard.
So it's just funny. We just go, we just do it. Because what else are we going to do? So, and that's part of where this podcast came from, because it came right before COVID. I didn't know COVID was going to happen, but I got tired of being lost in the box in the basement by myself.
Yeah.
Because I know I'm not. There's so many of us out there doing it, but we don't know each other. We don't have time to talk to each other. We can't even go to each other's gigs, most of us. So it's not like back in the day people would be, in a community and they say, oh, such and such person's playing over here, let's all go. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
So people don't know each other. So it was just a way for me to create a salon atmosphere and to talk mm-hmm. to other musicians and say, hey, good on you for doing what you do. Thank you for doing it. And keep going. Yeah. So that's what this show has been about for me. And there's no money in this either. So, but it's fun. I think it's a creative way for people to hear and see some of the other things that we do and to create this business. Yeah. So you've been writing books as well. My gosh.
It's another career that pays almost nothing unless you're Stephen King. Yeah, I just released my new book. I just got this 4 days ago. Drive all day because I'm too old to drive all night. It's a memoir and partly stories from the road and just what it's like for a working musician. I have a whole chapter where I rant about Spotify. Maybe I should be glad I'm a small independent writer because if Spotify found out about me, I'd probably hear from their lawyers, but they make me angry. They treat us like commodities and I don't like that. But there's also a lot of good stuff in there. I talk about the festivals that I've been to. I've got a chapter about Alex Dobkin and one about Alison Bechdel. And I have 25 things you should never say to a musician. Like, you had insurance on that, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I've never had insurance on anything. Because I could never afford the deductible or the payment thing. So I just was like, okay, I can't
yeah.
do that.
It's expensive. And frankly, the only reason that my instruments are insured is that my union gives me a discount.
Okay.
So my pension will be vested this year and I think I'm going to lose my insurance. So I got to decide what to do.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Cause I will no longer be an active member of the union. We'll see how that goes, but I've been really lucky. I should be knocking on wood right now because you know how it is when you're traveling with your baby.
Yeah.
And you hand it over to an airline clerk yourself. But I've been really lucky. They have dropped my guitar so hard that it's dislodged the electronics inside. Ugh. And fortunately, I could reach inside with some duct tape and fix it for the gig. And I had a good case for it, so there wasn't any permanent damage. But yeah, it's really scary. And every time if I'm driving to gigs, and I play several instruments, but I play three in concert. So I've got three instruments out in the car, maybe an amp and some mics too. And every time I lock the door to go in and get a sandwich for lunch, I have to like visually put white light around it because yeah. even if my insurance will cover outright theft, you know how it is when you bond with an instrument. It's like I could get another instrument, the same model and make, and it wouldn't be my guitar.
It's not the same. No, yeah. It's not the same. And you picked the one that you wanted and you played it. So it's got your essence in it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Vibrates yeah. at the level that you need. And there's a lot of truth to that. I have one time only, and I haven't done it since. I let somebody play my fiddle one time and I got it back. And I'm, what is wrong with this? It's not playing right because they changed the way they played it, vibrated in such a different way. It changed the way when I got back to it, it wasn't mine anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no one's ever touching this again. And it took me a solid 2-3 days to get it back to what it was supposed to be. Because they played it so intensely or whatever they did. It was mm-hmm. like their vibration was just different.
Yeah, so, I don't let people play my instruments either. I have a beater guitar that I give to my students if they need something. But that's mm-hmm. like my beach guitar. That one's not quite as important. Not my good guitars. No way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how that happens. And people think you're just woo-woo. And I'm like, no, there's got to be scientific evidence.
There's something. And there's always that player who sweats all over it. I mean, sometimes it's gross. It's like, get away from me.
Yeah, so that is all true. That is all true. So is there anything that you've done that you wish you hadn't have done as far as like creating albums, or is there like any music out there that you would have pulled back if you could go back and do it again? Or is there anything that you would have wished you had added to something that you left off?
Well, there's always regrets after recording, always, because there's always something else you can do to it. There's mm-hmm. always that song you can add or that instrument you can add, or why did I hire that bass player or whatever the thing is. But I can't say I've ever looked at any of my recordings and went, ew.
Okay.
There are a few songs that didn't weather time very well. I'm not saying that, like my beginning songs. And that's the thing about being a musician is that almost everything you do is in public. So if you record or perform, it's done. It's out there. People have heard it. And a few of my early songs, I'll think, oh my gosh, why did I write it that way? Or what the heck is that chord? Or, but you know, I've recorded 13 albums, so I've recorded a lot of songs. So I did do one album. Most of my albums have been done with overdubs. Not my favorite way to play because I really like to play off the other musicians. And you as a jazz musician, jazz players are like totally like that. I cross the line with a lot of different styles. And anyway, so most of mine have been overdubbed, but I did do one album that was largely live. Mm-hmm. And I can still hear the mistakes that we had to leave in. And I don't like that, but I think that's just me being extra particular. How musicians are, we have hearing like dogs. Right. Can't you hear that bad note that bass player's playing? And other people will be like, what? Half the time they don't even know there's a bass. That's the thing.
That's true. Yeah, that is definitely true. Huh. That's one thing about being a quote unquote jazz player. I don't even know if I like to call myself a jazz player anymore because I'm an improvisational player because I'll play anything. And sometimes I do play anything.
Yeah.
In the sense of, because it's a lot of the stuff the last 10 years I've been doing what Bobby McFerrin does, but I'll do it with other musicians and we just go out there and I'll say, you start, go. And that's what we do. So it's not really jazz, but it is. Because you have to have that improv thing down. But yeah, you do have to have ears like dogs because everybody's, okay, I'm going to do this other thing. Let's see if they catch it here. I'm throwing this to you, catch.
I know a woman who is a jazz pianist. Mm-hmm. And I said, I've always wanted to ask a jazz player this. Very often with jazz, y'all start with the melody and everyone's all together. And then you go off into outer space and you improv and you're all around. And then somehow you end up back at the melody.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a long time later. Sometimes it's just a few measures later. I said, how do you do that? How do you know where you are? And she paused and she said, we don't. And I went, oh.
That sometimes when that happens, that's not necessarily a good thing.
partly she was being funny,
yes.
but because she is so accomplished, I know what key we're in.
Yeah.
And if I get confused at what the drummer or something is doing, I just pull back and listen and then I can jump back in. Mm-hmm. And that's part of having good ears. And really, I think that improv is like the height of creativity because you can write out a part and notate it and play that exactly. And that's creative, but it's not as creative, I think, than saying, okay, we're all playing this song together. We're starting on a G, go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very exciting and terrifying to most people.
But I think it depends on the genre, actually, from what I have found. Sorry, I didn't mean to point.
Go ahead.
Yeah, because I've worked with a lot of different musicians in my career and classical musicians are the hardest to deal with in terms of improv because they're used to reading a piece of paper. And some of them can write their own parts, but they have to have that piece of paper in front of them. But guitar players, most of them don't read. So they don't know. They don't really care. They're like, oh, what key is it in? Oh, is it 1-4-5? Okay. And then they go. And so they're not quite as afraid of improv because they grew up playing in rock bands or bluegrass bands or whatever. I remember when I hired a cellist for my first album, I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew I wanted a cello on this song. And so I called up the local university and I called the music department and I said, I need the name of some cellists who have recording experience. And he goes, do you want them to improvise? And I'm like, yeah, I don't read music. I'm not going to write out their part for them. And, oh, okay. And he gave me, oh, this is a side chat. We can talk about this in a minute if you want. But he gave me the names of two guys. And I said, you don't have any women who play cello? Oh, yeah. And he gave me her name. And I called her. As it turns out, not only could she write her own part, but she had recording experience. She'd worked in studios in L.A., I'm like, dude, you should have given me her name
first.
But, and so there I was, my most of my experience is in folk music and we just jam. And she brought in a piece of music. She had carefully notated out her entire part, and that's what she played. It was beautiful. It was perfect. I'm not saying it was wrong, but it was like, really? So you had to do it that way? That was a totally different approach.
I guess that way you knew exactly what she was going to do. She knew exactly what she was going to do. You knew when she was going to come in. That kind of thing. I understand it too, because I started out as a classical player. I started out with classical piano and classical voice and classical violin. But it was like too much the same. I don't want to do it the same way every freaking time. And I was in the orchestras and I love Brahms Fourth Symphony, but how many times am I going to play Brahms Fourth Symphony? Right. Let's play something else.
You know?
It's like, we're in community orchestras. So there's only so much a community orchestra is able to do.
Right.
I get that. There's certain pieces that you do because that's the level of the group. And that's fine. I don't think I'm a great orchestral player. I don't think I'm like the best classical player in the world. So I know we can't do certain things. But it was just like, there's still a hell of a lot more music than that. So why are we sticking in this little area?
Yeah. You know? Well, when you're playing with a huge string section, you have to.
Yeah.
It's not jamming with a pop band.
And things have changed too, because that was high school and college. So we're talking 35, 40 years ago. Now you've got orchestras that, because a lot of orchestras have actually, they don't even exist anymore. A lot of orchestras have gone defunct because people stopped going to see orchestra. Quite a few big orchestras have gone down.
Yeah.
So now they're definitely, they play Queen. They play stuff that people can bite-sized chewable pieces they can listen to now.
Right.
So they had to expand how they do things. They do movie soundtracks with movies so people will come. All kinds of things now that they've finally had to say, wait, let's reach outside of this. But there was all kinds of classical music they never even played.
Yeah.
So you're like, because, you know, these are the 10 composers you must play. I'm like, who says this? There's thousands and thousands of composers. So it's really interesting. There's a lot of opera being written right now. I'm not sure what that's about. It's like all of a sudden new opera everywhere. So it's cool. But I'm just like, how odd is that? Wayne Shorter just wrote an opera.
Cool.
With Esperanza Spalding. Like, okay then. So new stuff all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're reaching into different realms now.
Yeah.
So you've got your stuff is folk based, singer songwriter based. You're writing books. Did you ever think you'd be writing books?
No. No, that was out of my realm of thinking. I've always been a voracious reader. Writing was something people who went to university did, or people who were rich did. I never thought that was in my realm, but I know I just, my first book was a memoir also, Drive All Night, because I'm not very creative with titles, Drive All Night, Drive All Day. But I played at this inn. The next morning at breakfast, I sat with a couple of women who'd been to my show. And I was telling them stories from the road, and they were laughing so hard they could barely swallow their eggs. And I thought, maybe I've got something here. One of them said, you should write a book. And I'm like, oh, ha ha. But I was stuck at this inn. I shouldn't say stuck. It was a lovely place, but I was there for 2 or 3 days. It was freezing. It was November. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what am I going to do? So I started this book, and I started writing down stories. And I found that it was really fun. I'm a longtime journal writer, so I just wrote, it was my journal, only not quite as personal and a little more interesting than what I had for breakfast. My journal's actually pretty boring, but so that's what got me started. I put that book out, and I was touring a lot when that first book came out, and people bought it and told me they enjoyed it. And I thought, okay, maybe I got something here. And then here I've got, this is my first book, Drive
Night.
Yeah. And then in 2011, we lost Teresa Dell, who was a singer-songwriter in women's music. Hers was the first live women's music I'd ever heard. And she was quite an inspiration to me. And when she passed away, that kind of slapped me upside the head because it made me realize that we're losing a lot of women in women's music. Mm. You know, Kay Gardner had already passed away, and I can't remember Maxine Feldman. And I thought, someone should write a book. And so I approached all my writer friends, and I'm like, write a book about women's music, write a book. And they're like, no, I don't have time. I've got, no, whatever it was. And then I realized I wrote a book once. Maybe I could write another one. So then I wrote An Army of Lovers, which is much different than the memoir. I did so much research for it. It took me 8 years to write it. And over 100 interviews, but I really enjoyed the interviews.
So Jamie, please tell us about your new book.
I'm really excited about the release of my third book, Drive All Day, Because I'm Too Old to Drive All Night. The ebook is available right now at the usual suspects, including Goldenrod Music, Amazon. So be sure to look for it. And like my first book, it's a collection of true life stories from a musician who has toured and taught for over 30 years. I've got stories about my travels, like my trip to Dollywood with my mother, where I learned that if you ride the roller coasters, you should bring a jumbo bottle of ibuprofen with you. I talk about my trip to New York City, where I came this close to appearing on the TV show Kelly and Ryan. I have stories about my students, including the excuses that I get, some that are very creative, like she didn't practice because we couldn't find her guitar. Turns out her guitar was in the back of their van for a week. It was so covered with stuff they couldn't find it. I have a chapter about Alex Dobkin, one about Alison Bechdel. I tell you about the festivals that I've gone to, and I'm going to read one of the chapters for you. This is about something that happened to me in Ottawa, Canada, where I live. When I first got the day hospice gig, I envisioned beds filled with weak-looking people, surrounded by solemn loved ones, my soothing music helping them rest. Turned out they'd rather hear 8 days a week or Wagon Wheel. I played in a comfortable living room, not a bed in sight. Usually, there was a raucous card game going on as a volunteer pushed a cart with snacks and juice served in elegant wine glasses. I always looked for Andrew when I arrived for my shift. When I first met him a year ago, a middle-aged white guy in casual clothes, brown hair carefully combed to the side, he was thin and moving slowly. Even though he kidded me about the ukulele, he sometimes looked my way and smiled when I did a song he liked. Turned out he just liked to hassle me since he played a superior instrument, the guitar. After being away for the summer, I came into the living room. I moved a chair, unfolded the music stand, and pulled the ukulele out of the case. While I tuned, I looked around for Andrew. When I didn't see him, my first thought was, did he pass? I always wondered when I saw someone 1 week and not the next. It could simply be that they recovered or went to another hospice. However, it could be the inevitable. 15 minutes passed before Andrew strolled into the room with an energetic step. He looked better than that first time, his color robust, so my thoughts switched to something more positive. Maybe he was recovering. I didn't know anything about Andrew's health. We weren't allowed to ask why the clients were there unless they brought it up. We only provided art projects, card games, food, massage, and music. I was usually background music for a decibel-busting card game. Someone played a good hand, and they all screamed with laughter, then pointed fingers at Andrew, accusing him of having cards up his sleeve. I didn't care that they found euchre more interesting than my music. They were there to enjoy themselves and perhaps forget about pain and hospitals and what their last test revealed. Once in a while, I saw a foot tapping or lips moving to the lyrics. Sometimes they clapped after I finished a song. Usually they didn't. They didn't know I'd toured for over 30 years or that I recorded 13 albums. It didn't matter. Andrew told me he liked Creedence Clearwater Revival, so 1 week I brought in songs for him. Partway through Bad Moon Rising, I realized it was one of those songs where you didn't really hear the lyrics until you sing them. There I was cheerfully singing about rage and ruin at the end of the world when I decided that one verse and a chorus was enough. I switched to Down on the Corner. An upbeat song about buskers was much better. 1 week I brought the guitar. Andrew grinned and commented, "You brought the big boy." "Big girl," I corrected, and we laughed. I'm good at faces, bad at names. I remember Andrew because he was there every time. He doesn't always recall my name, and sometimes he looks confused when I bring up his guitar playing, like he can't fathom how I know that he plays. Some weeks we've had conversations about kinds of music and guitars, but his meds probably scramble his brain. As long as he enjoys our talks in the moment, it's good. One day, Andrew was in the parking lot smoking a cigarette when I walked up for my gig. "Oh, good, it's you," he said between puffs. "When it's not you, that lady with the harp shows up, and I'm not ready for that yet." One day, an elderly gentleman slowly lowered himself into a recliner near me. A volunteer covered his lap with a blanket. He confided that he couldn't sing or remember the words to anything. I assured him that it didn't matter. When we got to the chorus of Brown Eyed Girl, I invited him to sing along. He softly sang in a creaky voice, "Sha la 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 ti da." "See, you can remember the words," I complimented him. A smile lit up his face. A young woman in her 30s was often there. She wore a turban and sat next to an oxygen tank. As I was packing up one day, she smiled and commented that she liked those old songs. Old songs? Did she not hear me play Riptide? Okay, one song out of 30 written after 1980 did not count. I had to give my musician's ego a firm down, girl. I was strumming a rhythmic song one day and looked up to see a thin woman, half her jaw missing, but still smiling and bouncing up and down. "I love that song," she exclaimed after I was done, telling me how much she loved that band. "Do you know anything else by them?" I didn't, but she was happy to boogie along to the next song I did. I only saw her that one time. The volunteers, mostly older women, were sweet. They sat near clients, talking or simply sitting in silence. One gave hand massages. One, in her 80s, was usually dressed in pastels, her white hair carefully coiffed. She clapped to my faster songs, usually offbeat. She sang, even when she didn't know the words. The clients were fairly mobile, some using a wheelchair or a walker, and only there for the day. We got them out of their house, gave their caretakers a break, and offered social time and something to do. One day, one of the volunteers leaned down close to me between songs and quietly said, "A client passed in one of the back rooms. He'll be wheeled down the hallway, and when that happens, there's a moment of silence." A few minutes later, she said softly, "It's time." I'd been singing Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. I stopped, the last chord gently fading away. We all turned toward the hall as a group of people, heads bowed, pushed a covered gurney slowly by. A minute later, the boisterous card game resumed, and I finished Hallelujah, fighting tears. That's called Hallelujah, and that's from my book, Drive All Day.
That was quite a story. What other things do you want to do on the bucket list?
I want your job. I would love to be a podcaster. In fact, that's on my list of things to do when I retire, if I retire, we'll see.
What does that mean, retirement?
I know, because I love talking to people. I'll stop strangers in the street and ask them, "Where'd you get that tattoo? Does that commemorate something? Tell me the story." And they're like, "Sure. Do I know you?"
It's great. If you want to do a podcast, I will help you get started. That is not a
problem. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm still teaching, so I need to get that pared down before I can tackle something that big.
Yeah, you have to get a new computer.
Oh, my God. You would be hysterical if you just saw the computer that I'm on right now. Right now, it's got a huge crack next to the touchpad. And do you ever see the movie Alien?
Yeah.
The alien busts out of that woman, right? Mm-hmm. It looks like something's trying to bust out of my computer. It's all cracked. It looks like there's a little fist on the other side. So, yeah, a new computer.
Okay. That's the start.
Yeah.
But it's actually not so hard. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it. Oh, so someday when you retire, maybe you'll do a podcast or a television show, because you can do a YouTube as well. So you could do both at the same time.
That would be great. I'm already on YouTube. I've got a pretty popular channel where most people come for guitar lessons, but I also have my performances up there.
Okay. Yeah, because you could just basically, you could do a video podcast.
Oh, that'd be fun.
But basically, it's just a Zoom call that you just put it up on the air and you have to edit it.
Yeah, yeah. I've actually participated in a few of those. Yeah, that would be cool. I've often thought I wanted to do a podcast called Gigs from Hell because you know how this is. When musicians get together, we have these stories about, yeah, I played there too, and they took the chicken wire down, and I still got hit with the beer, whatever their stories are.
Yeah. That's good. I like that. That's a new book.
I talk about my gigs from hell in my two memoirs. So
that could be.
Oh, that could be a whole book. You're right.
That's an interview book. Do it.
You are not helping me. I have already got way too much to do, but that would be really fun.
That would be fun. I'm the idea girl because I can't do them all. So I figure out, just give them to people.
You're just going
to
hand somebody, them out.
Somebody will do them.
Yeah.
Because they're good ideas. Yeah. I hate to see a good idea go to waste.
Yeah.
But, you know, and somebody hearing this podcast will probably hear that. And if you don't do it, that somebody else will do it.
Well, great. They should talk to me. I got a bunch of stories.
Exactly. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your stories and sharing your books and your music. And I couldn't have done this without you. So thank you.
My pleasure. I really appreciate you asking me. I really enjoyed it. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tia Time.